Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, director, and former Weekend Update correspondent, Bill Hader. As a high school kid growing up in Oklahoma, Bill Hader received a progress report from his French teacher that had remarkable foresight. Bill is very funny in class. He'll probably be on Saturday Night Live one day, it read. Although the next part was, he got a 37% on this test and he probably won't be speaking French. Bill had a natural gift for doing voices and impressions. And years later, he would indeed join Saturday Night Live. And for 8 years, he brought memorable characters to life, including fan favorites like his exasperated Vincent Price, the lecherous Italian Vinny Viducci, and of course, Weekend Update correspondent Stefan. As one of the most talented cast members on the show, it's hard to believe Bill when he tells me that it was never his dream to be on Saturday Night Live. After his 8-year stint on that show, and roles in a number of films, like The Skeleton Twins, Trainwreck, and Inside Out, Bill is finally realizing his dream with Barry, his upcoming HBO show about a hitman who really wants to be an actor. Bill directs, writes, and stars on the show. And because he favors truthfulness over funny gags, it's one of the most unique shows on television. In comedy, he says, it's so easy to come up with gags and little bits. It's a lot harder to make a person's emotional journey make sense. Bill Hader joins Off Camera to discuss storytelling and Barry, struggling with anxiety on Saturday Night Live, why he waited so long to pursue his filmmaking dream, and why everyone in his hometown thought he was on drugs. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hey, Bill.
Hi.
You know, I was thinking that it's surprising that you haven't been on yet, considering the proximity.
Yes.
That you often are from this very place.
Yes.
And we were talking earlier, but I love the idea that if we ever get in a pinch, can we just call you?
You just call me, man. Dropping my kids off across the street, and we live, like, super close to each other, so.
Well, we have a lot in common. We have 3 daughters each. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think I built this studio for the show, but I actually built it as a place where I could close myself in and have a moment of peace.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a white room where no one can bother me.
Yes, that's what they do with people when they go insane.
Pretty much, yes. This is a multi-purpose room.
It's a safe room. Yeah, exactly.
It's a sanitarium.
Yeah, it's a place where...
And occasionally it's a TV show.
It's where Dad goes to think. Yeah.
Dad's thinking again.
Dad's thinking in his white room.
Yeah. Well, listen, I've been a fan for a long time, I'm amazed with your career. I love the Documentary Now series. I've seen 4 episodes of Barry.
Oh, wow.
And it's great.
Oh, thanks.
And it's interesting, and it's almost like I don't want to say too much because there's a joy in discovering this show and seeing how it unfolds, but basically you play a hitman who stumbles into an acting class. But what is interesting about the show to me is that it doesn't seem to stay in any one genre.
Yeah.
There are some really hilarious moments. There's some really dramatic moments. There's like tense, action film moments.
Yeah,
the lines are blurred between how you would categorize the show.
Yeah, I like that though. It's this weird combination of being reading and watching and listening to a wide variety of things and being a huge fan of all these kind of desperate things, and then also just trying to just go with what the emotion of the characters are.
Right.
And it was always like, well, what do you do now? Or what would happen right now? And sometimes those things would line up in a funny way, and then sometimes it would, because of the nature of him being a hitman, it's like, well, he would have to kill this person or he has to kill this person, but how does he do it? How does it affect him emotionally? Because what I thought was interesting was that this isn't a kind of glib hitman, like the violence shouldn't be funny.
Right.
That was a big thing because, it's about a guy who he's really good at killing people, but it's destroying him. And so what he wants to do is be an actor and get in touch with some emotions and things like that. And he's bad at that. You know,
right,
we just thought that was a really funny So what you do is you come up with a weird premise like that, and then you just try to play it as realistically as possible.
So is it a comedy in your head?
No, I just think it's about a guy. It's just, you know, you're just following this guy.
Right.
You know, and it's like life in a way where, you know, you go, oh, we'd have to kill him. And then, you know, I think your brain immediately goes to, well, it's a comedy, so him killing this person should be funny. And you go, no, it should just be what it is, which is brutal and sad.
So do you have that debate with yourself on set where you're going, oh, I know how to make this funnier, but
yeah,
I shouldn't?
It happens in so many different areas of the show. We'll say, there's a scene where I have to kill this guy in his backyard, and I said we should see kid toys. So we should just have the thing that this guy has a child.
Right.
And not hit it over the head and not have Barry
you don't have a
kill
scene
a guy
with
and
the child guy. Watching.
Or yeah, or he kills the guy and looks up and sees, like, I love you, daddy, picture or whatever. But you should see the evidence of a kid. So, you know, there's a kid now that doesn't have a dad. And, you know, we talked about it and talked about it. And I remember at one point someone going, well, what if he can't kill him, so he takes some of the kid toys and has to, you know, whatever. And it was like, no. That's a different show. And it's like, but at least it's funny. Just so keep the mood buoyant and stuff, because the way it is right now, it's just so brutal. And it's like, well, that's what murder is. You know, I don't know what to tell you, but murder is pretty brutal. I don't know how else to do it, but, you know. And
I like that you're explaining this in the writer's room.
But
let me explain what murder is.
I get it in a way of when you're trying to stay to the tone of something, you know, and it's all about tone and going, well, we got to keep this buoyant, you know. And we would just decide, well, let's not. And what if he just chokes the guy and it just takes a long time? That's it. And people go, really? And you go, yeah, let's do that. And so you do it, and then it was great. We showed some of the episodes, and David Benioff, who does Game of Thrones,
yeah,
went, wow, that scene in the backyard's brutal. And I'm like, you make Game of Thrones? You know, where people are like, I mean, babies are massacred on that show,
yeah,
you know? But for some reason, he was like, that was rough, watching that, you just smother that guy for a while.
There's a discomfort in that the genre isn't, we don't have it in our
brain,
Rolodex.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, we know
yeah.
what kind of show this is.
Yeah, you don't have the full grammar of it where you're like, well, this should be having some sort of like funk music over it, right? Because it's like a Tarantino thing, or it's this kind of thing or that thing or
yeah.
whatever. And I always appreciated just, again, it was like you kind of come up with a genre type story, but then you play it incredibly real and you take out elements that would make it feel like a genre and just show it for what it is. And that was the trick in the writer's room, is anytime we could clue in on something where I would say, you know, or Alec Berg would say, does everybody relate to that? That's the emotion behind it, you know, and it just takes forever to figure that out.
Is there any connective tissue between having to figure out the logic of a sketch and what you're doing on this, or are the two things totally different?
They're different. Like on Documentary Now, we did this thing, Blue Jean Committee.
Yes.
About the band. And that could have been very sketchy, which it was. I mean, we had big, broad moves in that they went to sausage school and all this stuff.
Right.
But then the ending of it, we got to this thing where these two guys haven't seen each other and there's a lot of animosity between them. And I give credit to Reese Thomas and Alex Bono, where we hadn't written anything for when we actually see each other at the end of that show.
Right.
And they said, just I think it should just be awkward. And just, you know, that's how it would be, you know? How would it really be? And you would make kind of promises that you know you're not going to keep, you know? Hey, I'll see you later, but you know you're never going to see the guy again. And it became much more dramatic, and you realized, you know, like we shot that and it felt really good, and Reese and Alex were like high-fiving each other, but there was a part of Fred and I that were like, well, what's the joke? Is it funny? Is it like, what, like, it needs, we're doing a funny show. Isn't the tone of this airplane, you know, Naked
right.
Gun, you know, and it was like, no, this is good. And they saw a thing I think I didn't even see. And so when I saw it cut together, I went, wow, that was really great. Oh, wow, you can do that with this tone. You can match that a bit. And it gave me confidence going into Barry that you do give yourself these rules and you have to kind of like, let's just ignore them. And HBO is a great place to ignore those things because I think if we went into HBO and said we want to do a broad comedy where I'm playing a bunch of different characters, they'd be like, we're not really interested in that. But when I say, I want to play a former Marine that's dealing with the fact that he kills people for a living and he wants to take an acting class to get in touch with his emotions, they're like, that sounds hilarious, you know? But they just were really behind it from the get-go. And the fact that we, you know, in the first meeting with HBO, I said, you know, the violence has to be pretty real, you know? Oh, absolutely. It was never a question.
Right.
They saw cuts of the show, and I would always go, oh, brother, okay, they're not going to be into this. And they went, yeah, that was disturbing. Love it, you know? Or, wow, that was crazy. And then on set, kind of an earlier question you had of, it is so hard to try to convince, because they do it for a living, stunt guys, when they get shot, they do the dance thing.
Right.
You know, when they get shot.
They make a meal of dying.
They go, blah, 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 and they fall down. And Wade Allen, our stunt coordinator, had a reel put together on his phone of people actually being shot.
Well, that's great.
That was awesome.
I hope his kids didn't find
so
his phone.
So much fun.
God.
And you know, and it was this thing of you have to do nothing. You know, it's like you just, you know, it was like doing take after take of something of just going like less, you know?
Right.
Less, like it's a light switch going off, you know? And framing it in a way that's very just more locked off and less pushing in and people getting shot up. It's just locked off shot.
Right.
People get shot. And
it's
you're
a
just
murder.
Like, oh,
we don't have to over dramatize it.
Yeah, just you should feel uncomfortable or thrown by it as opposed to that was rad.
Yeah. No, yeah. But I hear what you're saying, and I think that the scary thing to go that realistic or, you know, steering away from things that you know will play funny or will play funny on the day. We've all seen films where they didn't know the tone they were trying to go for.
Yeah, it's that William Goldman quote of, you know, I think he's in the book The Season where he talks about why a thing didn't work because the actor's in one play, the director is directing another play.
Right.
The writer wrote another play and the set designer made another play. You know what I mean? It's not connecting. And I remember after the second or third week of Barry, turning to Alec Berg, and I was like, I think we're all making the same show. And he's like, I had the same thought. You know, you just,
right.
It's so many people that you have to kind of harness to see the same thing.
Well, what you're talking about is, it's really like the difference between a first-time director in a lot of cases mm-hmm. and someone who's made a bunch of films. Someone who could say when you get the best special effects guy in the business and he says, we can make it look like this, to be able to sit there and go, nah, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of first-time directors would let the special effects coordinator direct that scene.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And this is your directorial debut, correct? Mm-hmm. So what do you attribute, like, the ability to have the confidence to make those decisions like a more experienced director?
I think probably being on Saturday Night Live, I think being on that show, and you'd have to produce your sketches. So
okay.
You would say, okay, we're going to do this Vincent Price thing, so this is what the set looks like. We want a door that turns like this. We want a coffin thing that, you know, the piano could be here. You know, we're involved with all that and what everyone's wearing and what the hair should be.
Right.
So when people come out,
so you're sort of directing your sketches.
Yeah, when people come out, you go, that hair is wrong. It shouldn't. Yeah, can we bring Betty out here? Maybe, can the wig be this? You know, you just, that problem solving, that practical problem solving, that never goes away.
Did you feel any anxiety about that first day or?
No, I didn't really worry about that much. I think I was really excited. And I'm a really anxious person. I have like legit anxiety, you know what I mean? I think I probably have an anxiety disorder, you know, but it's more about, you know, being on Saturday Night Live, being up on stage. But actually making a thing is great because it's problem solving, you know? So you're just there practically going, looking at it because, you know, I know I can change it, you know, or someone might have a better idea. And
that's so interesting.
Know? But when it's locked in place and there's an audience there and I can't change anything, I don't like that at all. I'm hosting Saturday Night Live next week and I'm going to be a wreck. Like, I have to fully prepare
just
myself.
Just saying that right now, do something.
Oh,
to you.
Yeah. No, I get like flu symptoms. I just start to feel really dizzy and I get really like, my arms get really heavy, and I'm just like, oh, what is, I can't go out. And I remember one time, this is the biggest name drop in the world, I'm sorry, but I was backstage at SNL, and I'm like, my head's spinning, and I'm like, can I get some coffee? Paul McCartney's next to me, and Paul McCartney's like, oh, Joe, you know, you're nervous. That's what that is. So, no, you drink coffee, it's just going to make it worse. You should have some water. Maybe a little tea, maybe. And I was like, okay, Paul McCartney. He's just sitting there
in the hallway
like this. He's like, oh, you know what you are? You're nervous. That's what that is.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's crazy to hear you say that and the fact that you did, what, 8 years on Saturday Night?
Yeah, and I never...
How did you survive?
I mean, the first 4 years at SNL, I was like, I'm going to be fired at any moment. And I remember Lorne Michaels came up to me after a show and he said, you know, you could work here as long as you want, you know, just relax, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, for the first 4 years on SNL, I didn't sleep on Fridays, so I just couldn't sleep. So when I was doing the show, I'd been up for basically like, you know, 48 hours or something. And I just, so from Thursday when I woke up until Saturday at like 4 a.m. when we would get home, I was just up. Because of the anxiety of having to do the show. And I would have one line. I'd be, you know, here's your coffee, sir. But I would just be, you know, what if I put the coffee on the wrong? What if, what if, what if, what if, what if?
Right.
And so I see it when I watch reruns or watch things. I can see it. I can go,
you can see your own anxiety when you watch
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. For me, it's so apparent. But I do this thing where I kind of, I do that when I'm talking. I'll be talking to someone. If you watch it, I do it all the time where I'm in a sketch and I just will do that. And it's like an involuntary twitch because I'm so wound up so tight.
Really?
And then by the end of my time there, it kind of chilled out. And unfortunately, I started laughing a lot in sketches.
Well, because, that's so nasty.
Because I started calming down a bit, or I was kind of weirdly combating it with I don't care. It was like the end of the Wild Bunch. It was like every episode was like a suicide mission, so I was just like laughing and stuff. It was hard, man. It was always the impersonation that Chris, or one of our stage managers, his impersonation of me is this. Because I would do that. I'd be like backstage just doing that with my arms.
Trying
pacing,
to physically shake the anxiety from
the
your body.
Get the anxiety out of my body, and I'd be pacing around going, fuck, come on. You know, like just so. And so he just, yeah, I would always laugh about that. And then he would always go, you're going to be fine. You're going to be all right. So anytime I was like ever on update, they push you out. He's the guy who pushed me out. And he would always be like consoling me. I'd be sitting in the chair, you know, dressed as Stefan or Carville or whatever, and he'd be patting my back like, it's going to be fine. You're going to be okay. And then he would push
me
out. And then once you're out there, it's kind of like you could feel it ebbing out of you, you know? It's okay, I'm out here, it's happening, and you could feel it kind of, you know.
I watch your performances, and you're completely present, and I find you like one of the quicker minds I've ever seen on that show, and hearing that you were battling that.
The whole time.
It's kind of surprising
to
me.
Well, a lot of times that quickness is, I've been practicing that ad nauseum in my dressing room. So much of that is like, I'm reading this sketch over and over and over and over and over again, to the point where when I'm out there, you kind of just let it fly. And what helped me was a couple of things. One was I started meditating. That was helpful. And I mean, I had a doctor say, you should maybe just have a drink. And I was like, no. Like, I don't really drink. I don't do drugs. I'd be like, why don't you smoke a joint before you go out? I'm like, no.
A little bit of heroin.
A little bit of heroin will be so nice. And I'm like, no, I can't do that. But I would meditate. That was helpful. And then I would do this trick with my brain where I would come out, and if my first line, I played so many game show hosts on that show. And,
yes.
And my first line would be like, hello, ladies and gentlemen. That would be my first line. I would say, hello, boys and girls, or something else. Or like, how we doing, gang, or something else.
Other than this, what was written in the script.
Because then it would trick my brain into going, you screwed up. This is what you're afraid of. You screwed up, and you're still here. Lights are here. Everything's fine. And it would immediately relax me. Isn't that weird?
That's so
It was weird. It was like a... Because I went to a therapist, and she's like, what are you nervous about? I'm like, I think it's just something going wrong, you know? So I was like, why don't you just make something go wrong immediately, and your brain will relax. And it worked. It really worked for me.
Did it get to the point where... God.
Or Fred Armisen would just do something to make me laugh. Because that's the other reason I corpse so easily, is because I'm really tense.
But you corpse so easily.
Oh, yeah, that's the term for laughing, you know? You corpse. And Fred Armisen just had my number on every, you know, those Californian sketches. He would just elongate, what? Like, he would just do one little thing. What are you doing? Like that. And I would start laughing because I was wound up so tight, you know?
Yeah, it's like why some people, like, especially kids, you know, you get them laughing. And like with my kids, my daughter, if I touch her, the back of her neck in a certain spot, I know now it doesn't even tickle her. She's just conditioned.
Yeah, they're just, yeah, that.
And again, she's right there.
It's the anticipation of it. It's the, when we do Stefan and John Mulaney would change little things in the card to make, because he knows it'll make me laugh because I'm tense and there's a new thing there that I'm not expecting and I'll start laughing.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let's take a little break from the conversation and talk about your mouth. That's right, your teeth, your mouth, your breath. Well, obviously, we need to take good care of that stuff. We only get one of each of those things. Well, unless you're from Kentucky, you get more than one tooth. But the point is to keep all your teeth, and now there's a better way to do that. And that's Quip, the electric toothbrush that looks like it was designed by Apple and cleans like a premium electric brush, but without the high price. And when it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. I know that, and Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. So Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the bulkier traditional electric toothbrushes. Guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right onto your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or your carry-on. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, and here's the coolest part, Quip has a subscription plan that refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. And most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. But Quip did. So find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. Now think about that. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. Spelled getquip.com/offcamera. And now let's get back to the show.
So, knowing a little bit of your history, I know that your route to Saturday Night Live was very different than a lot of people's. And we've had about 10 people on the show who have done Saturday Night Live. And most of them say that the minute they saw the show, it was their dream to be on it one day.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't your deal at all, right?
No, I moved out here to be a filmmaker, to make movies and write movies. And
right.
That was always my goal from the get-go. And so I had my little group of friends, and we go see every movie on Friday and go to a diner afterwards and argue about what was good and what wasn't good. And I spent all my time thinking and watching movies and reading books, and you know, that was it, you know. And nothing was happening for, you know, 6 years. I was just a PA.
Were you making short films, or were you writing?
No, because I was writing. I think I was too self-conscious to say, well, I want to direct. I was not a, I'm from Oklahoma. It's like, you know, it's, you don't, if you say what you want to do, if you're boisterous at all or confident people, you know, it's an ugly quality.
Is that what you were taught?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, you know, it's just don't, just relax.
Really?
I mean, it's just kind of like, in general, it's very, very sweet, modest people, you know, and anything that seemed immodest or whatever.
Or above your station.
Above your station or whatever.
So would you have one voice in your head that would say, I want to direct a film, and the other voice would go, calm down?
Yeah, how?
Right. Yeah,
you can't say you're a director and you haven't done anything, you know? Or, I mean, I didn't say I was an actor. I couldn't call myself an actor until I was in this movie Skeleton Twins.
Right.
Did that, and then I was like, oh, okay, so I guess I'm an actor now, you know? Because I just, I've done sketch. It's like, you know, you, anyway. But I harbored this, you know, I wanted to be a director. And then I PA'd, and then you find yourself in this position where you haven't done anything creative. You came out to LA to be creative, and you're just sitting around, you know, delivering film elements to Photochem and, you know, and just driving around and going, what am I doing? So I took classes at Second City LA because I had this friend, Eric Filipkowski, who was like, hey, do you want to see my Level 5 show at Second City LA? And I went, sure. And I went, oh, wow, all these people are doing sketch comedy. Well, I like Monty Python and stuff like that. Maybe I'll go do that. I'll take classes.
So weird that you wanted to be a filmmaker, but you didn't take filmmaking classes.
No, I went to the New York Film Academy. You know, they advertise in the, well,
yeah,
in the back of the Premiere magazine,
right,
or whatever. So in 1996, I did that, but I couldn't get into any good film schools because my grades were bad. And so I went to a community college in Scottsdale, Arizona. I don't know why.
In Arizona.
Crazy fact. David Spade also went to the same community college.
Really? But so he was born in Arizona,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was born in Arizona, so that makes sense.
But you went from Oklahoma to Arizona.
Don't ask me why. I have no idea.
And then you were in danger of becoming lost on some pathway.
Oh, totally, totally. My folks were like, I remember coming home and my mom in tears, and she said, you got rejected from OU, Oklahoma University. Like the state school didn't accept you. And
aren't they supposed to have to take you?
Yeah. And she's like, they just said no. And I was like, oh, jeez. Well, that's not good. And I remember they had a scholastic night at our school where it was like participation trophies or whatever. And I went to a school, it was like 70 kids were in our graduating class.
Oh, tiny school.
Yeah. And me and this other dude, Ryan Fisher, were the only two people not invited. So I just remember being at a park with Ryan Fisher, like smoking cigarettes, like, fuck them, man. We don't need them, you know. We'll be all right. It doesn't matter, you know. And it's like, I mean, they were giving, you know, ribbons out for like, showed up to class, you know. Paid attention ribbon, you know. And I think everybody thought I was on drugs in high school or something. I had like, kind of like long hair, and I had like a goatee, and I look like Charles Manson kind of. But it was, I just liked movies, and I don't know. I remember I had an English teacher go, wait, Hader, you don't smoke the doobage?
Yeah, you got doctors asking you to drink. You got teachers. Yeah,
teachers being like, you should smoke weed. Like, you have to smoke weed because your grades are abysmal. You have to be stoned all the time. And I'm like,
there's got to be a reason.
No, I'm just watching a lot of movies and reading a bunch of, like, you know, so, science fiction books.
I mean, okay, so here's help me with this, because I watch you on Saturday Night Live, and clearly you're one of the most, like, you're one of the funniest and most talented people I've ever seen on that show.
Oh, that's
nice. And what I'm curious about is, do you think that at all during your formative years, your childhood, if you steered away from those natural instincts, or if you had them and didn't recognize them, or if nobody recognized them, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. It's like I always did impressions of people, you know, or, you know, I went and, because my high school girlfriend was auditioning for the Glass Menagerie, I went and auditioned, and it's four parts in that play, and I got in the play.
Right.
And was kind of like, oh, that's weird.
You didn't get a ribbon for that?
I didn't get a ribbon for that. It was a gentleman caller in Glass Menagerie, but...
But that didn't say to you, oh, this is what I should be doing?
No, it was like a thing to do, and it was the same thing to me as, you know, playing basketball or something, but... I will say, when I was in the best review I ever got was my dad coming up to me after that play, and he was so, because he really, you know, Oklahoma, it's like big sports kind of thing, and I was really tall for my age, and so basketball or football, and I mean, I was in a lot of sports when I was growing up.
Right.
But I was never a fan, really. I remember going, oh, I'm in the play, I hope my dad's cool with me being in the play or whatever. He was ecstatic. He went, you were so good. How'd you memorize all those lines and I this? And his enthusiasm, I think, really meant a lot to me. So I think I kind of, an acceptance of it, I think it was this little thing in the back of my head kind of going like, well, maybe you're good at that, you know? And then when I went to Second City, L.A. years later, another moment where I went, okay, maybe I'm kind of good at this.
You know? Is there an example of an early moment of Second City where, like, a light bulb went on for you?
Honestly, you had to audition to get into the final two levels there. And I did my audition, and they had, like, these evaluating things where the head of the theater would call you over. It's this weird thing. We're all in the parking lot over in Crescent Heights. You know where the improv is?
Yeah.
Crescent Heights. So that parking lot next to it, we're all milling around there, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and the head of the, you know, Second City LA is over in the corner, and he would call you over to...
Just to the other part of the parking lot.
Just the other part of the parking lot to say, you didn't make it in, or you were great, but you need to work on blank, you know, you need to work on this, or whatever. And I remember he called me over, and he just went, and he was looking at his notes, he went, you're really good at this. Yeah, you're in. And he was like, okay. So-and-so, you know, and that was all he said was, you're really good at this. And no one had told me I was good at anything for years. You know, it was like I'd make a short film and I would get in my head and go, oh, this stinks, and I wouldn't cut it together because, you know, you had, you know, your friends at that age are like, you know, if it's not Taxi Driver, it's right. Like, what is this, dude? You know, and you're like, you know, that... And it was the bad thing about hanging out with film geeks. We all were so hard on things because it had to be the best thing imaginable because you were only measuring your head towards the best films, the best, you know, writing, the best everything. And very rarely do you achieve that. It has to come in steps.
Right.
You know? And I would get in my head and go, oh, this isn't what I want it to be. This isn't good. And so it was a lot of insecurity. So having someone say, hey, you're really good at this, meant a lot.
Right.
And then very quickly after that was when Megan Mullally called me when I was an assistant editor at Iron Chef America. And I was, you know, the nighttime assistant editor on that show. And
so you were very close to just like...
Becoming like an editor.
Post-production guy.
Yeah, it would be like a post-production coordinator kind of person. And I was doing that, and I was in a Second City show, and her brother-in-law, Matt Offerman, Nick Offerman's brother, was in that show. And Matt and I are friends, and Megan Mullally called me and said, hey, I know you don't know me, but I was at the show last week. I had dinner with Lorne Michaels yesterday, and I told him about you, and he'd love to meet you. And I was like,
and how long have you been doing Second City at this point?
Like a year. And wow. I just went, okay. All right. And then, you know, someone beeps in and it's a New York number and I'm like, hello? And I was like, hi, my name is Lindsay Shookus. I work at the talent department at SNL. Lorne Michaels would love to meet you. Can you fly out tomorrow? Sure, you know? And next thing I know, I'm in an office with Lorne and he's like, do you know why you're here? I go, you saw Megan Lally saw me in his show? And he's like, yeah. And then he said, I was on a boat once with a guy, and he was being funny in the way that Bill Murray's funny. And I thought to myself, I know Bill Murray. And that was it. And I go, right.
That was it.
And he goes, it was very nice meeting you. When are you flying back? I go, I was going to fly back tomorrow. It was Friday. And he goes, you should stay and watch the show. Stay and watch the show on Saturday. And that was it.
That was the entire meeting.
Yeah. And then Topher Grace, when Topher Grace hosted SNL, he's taking questions from the audience and it cuts to the audience and you see way in the background me and Mike Shoemaker standing against the thing. If you find it, yeah, it's me in a white shirt, you know, like, what am I doing here? I can't believe I'm here right now. This is
And
so
that's
cool.
Just in the audience. You can't believe you're in the audience.
I can't even believe I'm in the audience. And I just went, well, I'll be able to tell my grandkids. I one time met Lorne Michaels.
I was on Saturday Night Live.
I actually was on Saturday Night Live. You could see me way in the background.
And that would have been enough.
That would have been enough. I mean, I went back elated and...
Go back and you're cutting Iron Chef America?
Yeah, I was like, this is rad. Well, I just, you know... Actually, I was, I didn't say anything to anybody. No one knew. I said, I got to take off tomorrow. And
that's got to be the weirdest thing in the world.
Yeah, so I didn't say anything to anybody. And then he came to L.A. and saw me at Second City. We totally packed the audience with our friends, so we blew the roof off the place. And Lorne was like, were those all your friends in the audience? And I said, yes. He's like, all right, then you have to come
to
New York.
I've seen this trick before.
He's like, yes, no. Ellen Cleghorn did this. And and then he had me come out to New York. And so they flew me out to New York with this sketch group I was in. And at UCB Theater on 26th Street, and in the audience was all these kind of New York improvisers going, who the fuck are these guys? And in the front row was Tina Fey, Seth Meyers, Amy Poehler, Lorne, Marcy Klein, like everybody.
And what'd that do for the anxiety?
Oh, gosh. I just was going to pass out. I was like, this is just too much. This is just too much. I can't. But you know what the problem with at that point? It wasn't that. It was too much. But there was also part of me that was like, I got nothing to lose. You know, like, this is cool. You know, we'll see what happens.
Right.
I got nothing to lose.
It wasn't your dream.
It was like, well, this is crazy. Let's see what happens. but it was really nerve-wracking. And then the bad thing was then you get the show and you're elated.
Right.
And that's when the real anxiety kicked in for me, was that now you have something to lose. And like you said, it was never a thing you kind of dreamed of, but you were a fan of SNL.
Right.
Obviously, it wasn't like I wasn't a fan, but I wasn't kind of like the all-consuming comedy fan that like Andy and those guys were.
Well, it seems like, you know, when you skip steps like that, it could be a very, I would assume,
jarring,
unbalancing thing.
Oh, for 4 years, I was very aware of that, and then the anxiety didn't help. And then, so it was a real thing of having to push through this and then realizing, like, this is never going to go away. I just have to manage it.
Right.
Yeah. It's just, I think, part of being an anxious person is you just worry a lot, and you're always looking at, you only think in worst-case scenarios, you know.
Right. Did it manifest itself more on a show like Saturday Night Live than it does, say, when you're filming Skeleton Twins or when you're doing Barry?
Oh, I'm so happy filming stuff. I'm never...
Even though you have to star in it.
You know, I star, directing, writing, all that stuff. I'm so much more relaxed. I feel like in my element doing that much more than... performing live or something. You know, I've been asked to do theater and stuff like that, and I don't think I could. That is just like a whole other thing that I'm so impressed with. Or stand up too. When I watch stand ups, I just am like,
yeah. Well, it's so interesting to me that with so little experience, you were thrust into the biggest, you know,
yeah,
the example of what American sketch comedy is on television, the height of that. Like, yeah, even when you go out and it works, the first message would be, well, I got lucky that time.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, you're just constantly waiting for someone to tap you on the shoulder and be like, excuse me, what are you doing in here? You know, and you go, they hired me. It's like, no. Come with us.
Did you find any joy in doing it? Like, where was the joy in Saturday Night Live?
There was a couple of times, like on the sketches. We did a Vincent Price once. With John Hamm, where he was James Mason, that was a lot of fun, where I felt very relaxed. And I did Rick Perry once on Update when he was drunk, and that was fun.
Maybe there's something to the drinking thing.
Yeah, drinking. It was more just feeling out of control or uneasy with. Because they would just hand you a thing and say, hey, this changed and now this is this. And
right. Well, I will say there's something to a bunch of people scurrying around in headsets, counting down.
Oh, well, that's the thing is that Jenna, I love her. Jenna, our stage manager, I love her dearly. She's one of the most beautiful human beings on the planet. But she's worked there for so long. And when she does the countdown, she's so terrified. It's like, 5 minutes. 3 minutes, 3 minutes there, Bill, where are you? And you can't not be like, oh,
yeah.
I did Elliot Spitzer once on a cold open, and I got so nervous doing that when it ended the next day, I had a fever, chills, like my whole body broke down, and I was sick for like a week, because I got so just, my defenses were up the whole week doing it, and I just didn't enjoy it. If you watch me, I'll be like doing something, and I don't know what to do with this hand.
Really?
It's like all my nervous energy goes right up into this arm, and I'm just going like this. So that was the thing with Stefan, was that I could talk slow and put my hand over my mouth, which is kind of what I want to do. And I remember
I always thought you were just hiding when you were laughing.
No, that's kind of what I just kind of want to do, is just cover my face for some reason. I remember I did an Update feature to John Malkovich or Carville, and I had my hand in front of my face the entire time I was doing it. I remember Alex Bays going, dude, you gotta put your hand down. No one can see your face, and you're like talking down. And I'm, I was like, I know, I'm just nervous. I'll work on it, you know.
A few times in my life when I've gone through anxiety and fear, and I always thought it was my gut telling me, you have to make a change.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems like there's valid logic to, oh, all this is happening to me physically. I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah, it is a feeling of and that was what we kind of put in a Barry, is like you're built for something, but there's something about you that in your mind and your emotions that can't handle it. It's like this weird dichotomy in your body, you know. It's like, oh, you're able to do these impressions, you could do these characters and all these things. And
Does the voice stuff come so quickly to you?
And yeah, but since I was a kid, but my sisters do it, my dad does it, like we all, when we tell stories, we do voices. And so that was always a thing. I remember being, before I hit puberty, doing Bart Simpson, and everybody would call kids or like, watch, he does Bart Simpson, and I would do Bart Simpson, like, and it was just like a imitating teachers and stuff, but it was something that, to be honest, I kind of just took for granted that I had that ability to do that.
Right.
And then, I think we have a progress report from my French teacher that says Bill is very funny in class. He'll probably be on Saturday Night Live someday.
You're kidding?
Yeah, 37%.
What he won't be doing.
He will not be speaking French. But I was constantly joking around, but a lot of that joking around is like a nervous energy of wanting to, that it's okay to be kind of just quiet and silent, you know. There's always like
right.
That silence starts to make you a bit, oh gosh, what's going on here? Are we okay? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I think
I grew up in a house
where everyone, a lot of noise and everyone talking, and a lot of, you know, I had two younger sisters, and my parents are both very kind of outgoing people, and so Yeah, it took me years to figure out when someone was quiet around me that they weren't mad at me. You know, I always feel like, what did I do? You know, and I was like, I'm thinking.
Say something.
I'm just eating my asparagus or whatever. And I'm like, well, what did I do? You know, I was very, very touchy.
God. You know?
And then you just kind of go, relax, man. You just, it's your head, you know.
Yeah, and I would imagine that's hard to present a sketch and if someone's sitting there thinking about it or whatever, you want to jump in and go, okay, that one wasn't any good.
Oh, I did that yesterday. I called someone from SNL yesterday and said, hey, we were thinking about possibly doing a monologue like this, and I did it. And she went, oh, okay. And it was quiet. And I go, or not. We don't have to do it. You know what? Let's not do it. Click.
You're like, delete contact from
delete
phone?
Delete contact. I just threw the phone out the window and then just sat down like, oh, gosh. Oh, no. Yeah, no. But I don't want to give the impression that I'm like, you know, this nervous wreck all the time. It really is just in terms of like anticipating something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, anticipatory anxiety and getting up in front of an audience.
Like, you do on Saturday Night
The
Live.
Things that, the, yeah.
Well, there's something you said that I wanted to bring up. You said it, and you said it in several different ways. You said that nobody knows anything.
Yeah.
And to be an artist and hear those words, I think, is incredibly reassuring. Yeah. Because to hear it from someone who's, you know, who's had success on the highest level and to still say, you know, the way to great art is to not think that I know what I'm doing. And when I hear you talking about all of this, all the anxiety and everything, I feel like the common denominator is you just didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, you just, it's the unknowable aspect of it.
And the out of control aspect of it, right?
Out of control aspect of it. You just want to be able to control things and you can't. But that's where the best stuff comes out of. And you always, the funny thing is that you just have to trust yourself, you know, that you'll be able to get through these things, you know? And instead of saying, what if, say, so what, you know?
Is comedy still a mystery to
you? Oh, totally. Why something works in any way, I have no idea, you know? All you could just follow your instincts and just say, well, like I was saying earlier with like the emotion of things, is that something I can relate to? You know, is that something you relate to? But it's a lot of it is instinctual, and it's like, what's the truth of this would be this instead of, let's find a dumb joke here.
Right.
And I think also like when you're younger, it's fun just to be funny. You kind of just like stuff that's stupid,
right?
You know, and you just, I mean, that was my favorite comedy forever. And I would actually
like
go,
Monty Python, like the,
yeah, Monty Python and Airplane and Naked Gun and all that stuff. And I still love that stuff, but when you're young, you love it. And then as you get a little older, you actually start to experience life. And then you have like a little bit more sympathy for your characters in some places. And then also you get, you see in comedy sometimes how kind of easy that is, you know what I mean? Of just coming up with gags,
right,
or bits or whatever. It's a lot harder to make just a story make sense and you know, a person's emotional journey makes sense, you know?
Does it feel like cheating when you fall back on like something that you know you could do easily?
No, but it's a thing Alec taught me, which was, you know, if it feels like a joke, we should cut it. You know,
right.
If it feels like a joke, let's just, I'd rather have nothing there than a thing that feels like we're pushing the comedy, you know, which is kind of scary.
Yeah, you know? I mean, what you're saying is like, okay, here's this guy we know who's come up in comedy and sketch, and what you're talking about is you've been relieved of the burden of having to...
Yeah, well, sometimes you just go like, well, do you need a laugh here? And sometimes you feel like you do, but then sometimes it's better just to have nothing there and just let it be what it's supposed to be. And then
right.
And then the funny thing is that it makes all these other comedy kind of come up. It's a weird... I would see it in the cut, especially when we would edit it, and you would take out a kind of a big swing joke, and suddenly these other little moments that didn't really feel funny to me suddenly like rose up and became really funny. But if you were thinking of like, just because there's a space there where there's no laugh, and then you go, well, we got to manufacture something, you run the risk of it now, it doesn't feel real. I don't know what right. world I'm in.
Well, it'd be like making a show by committee and showing it and then...
Yeah, and they go, couldn't there be a laugh right here? And HBO doesn't really do that, which was nice. I mean, there's an episode 7 of Barry where there's a bunch of stuff that happens in that episode that's really just awful and
well,
sad.
We can look forward to that.
Yeah, sad. You can look forward to that, but it's really a very emotional kind of... it's the episode that everybody, when they've seen them all, they go, geez, that was... Wow. We didn't know it was going to go there. HBO didn't bat an eye at it. And it was that thing where it's like, oh, can we have scenes like this? So a lot of it is just like, leave it alone. Just let it just play itself out, you know? It's like you kind of put all these things, you know, on top of the
wall. You wound everything up.
You wound everything up and then you let go and just see what happens instead of going, well, God, I really want this to go here because it'd be really funny if this happened. Go, I feel like we're pushing it. You know, you would hear that a lot in the writer's room. Liz Sarnoff, who's one of our writers, is great at going, I feel like you're pushing it, guys. And you go, yeah, you're right. You know, oh. Or we really would get excited about these two characters meeting, you know, where these two characters hook up with each other or whatever. And, you know, sometimes people just go, why? You know, you go, well, because, and I think what happens sometimes is people, maybe they get, I don't know if they get too successful or whatever, but I've seen people sometimes surround themselves with a bunch of people who go, that's great. You know, that is so funny, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, man, I need someone there. You know, I like a room, a very small room of people who go, what? You know, and challenge you on everything, you know?
I'm fascinated with this because I think what you're saying is simultaneously, like, you have to be able to give up control. And you also, you have to keep your impulses in check of oh, I can make this funny.
Yeah.
It's almost like your path has been to prove that whatever your weird interests are, they're valid. To take the thing you're most interested in, the weirdest, most specific thing to you, and put it out there in the world and have other people respond to
it. Yeah, and okay, well, this is honest. I don't understand it, you know. You know, you have these, you know, I could have done a show about a guy getting a sketch comedy show and getting an SNL and not knowing what to do, but that wouldn't be very interesting for me to try that. You know, more interesting to have it be, because I think violence and, you know, like the beginning of 2001, you know, like the first thing the humans did was beat the shit out of each other. You know, and then this inherent violence in people is something that I find interesting, and I've always found interesting in movies and stories and things like that. And I don't know why, you know, but I just do. And so it's like, well, I want to write something about someone hating that in themselves and trying to get rid of it and trying to get in touch with his emotions and what that brings up in him, you know?
Right. Well, at the core, it's a story about someone figuring out who they really are.
Yeah,
right?
I think people could relate to that of having a job that you hate, and then, but I want to do this, but I'm not really good at this thing. You know, you see that happen, and I mean, it happened to me in some way, you know? I think I don't feel like I'm bad at filmmaking. I just don't feel like it came as easily to me as doing voices and being funny, you
right.
know? And so it was something you had to, you know, I'd be so much more interested in like storyboarding a sequence than going up on stage and performing.
But it is notable that like you're basically the guy that got called straight to the NBA from high school,
yeah.
dropped to 40 on somebody, and yeah. then is like, yeah, but I don't know if the NBA is really
for me. I
want to
work on cars.
I mean, it is.
I want to have my own garage. Why?
Why?
I don't know. I just want to have my own garage. But that's that irony. It's a thing it comes at a weird cost.
Well, listen, I like you and I admire you because I think there are examples of those people that they're too afraid to, you know, go do the thing and try the thing that they really want to do. And
yeah,
so,
and I'm in a lucky position because of SNL and this thing I did for 8 years that, I mean, don't get me wrong, I want to make this very straight. I had a lot of fun there. it wasn't like I was hating my life every moment. I really learned so much, and I owe sitting here everything to SNL. I mean, that's the...
Well, I mean, you are across the street.
I am across the street.
You probably could have talked your way in.
I walked in here, and I just put a mic on myself, and Jared Leto or someone's out there being like, wait, who's in there? But yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. Hating it. It was just that it came at this cost that I had to try to just manage, like I'm talking about. I think really what it is, I get uncomfortable when a lot of attention's on me. I think that's what it is too. Is I just don't like it when there's attention on me. I think it makes me nervous.
Again, that makes total sense.
It makes sense, and I the funny thing is, a lot of people when they have attention on them, they kind of get quiet, and I weirdly can't stop talking. I weirdly just start running at the mouth. And that's usually a sign of, I met George Saunders, one of my favorite writers, and Tobias Wolff are two of my favorite writers.
Yeah.
And I got to go to a dinner or lunch with them.
It was lunch with
other people. I talked the whole fucking... I was driving back going, what is wrong with you? You know, it's that awful feeling when you're just driving back going, what is wrong? Like, these are two of the most amazing minds on the planet to me, and I'm such a massive fan of them, but I was so nervous that I would not stop speaking. And in my head, I'm going, Bill, stop talking.
But you can't. You got
it. But I go, because it's just like, because if I stop talking, you guys are going to, I don't know what it is.
You could talk all day on this show, because I'm fascinated by you, and I think that I don't understand the artists that keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And so I really admire what you're doing with the show.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
It's nice to get to know you a little bit.
Oh, thanks, bud. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, and now, you know.
I'll be your Ed McMahon, too, if you need a...
Great.
Just a guy around the corner.
I love it.
Going, that's right, Jared Leto.
Yeah, maybe you can just hide behind the wall and pop out every now and then when...
It's like, well, that's interesting, Octavia Spencer. Well, hello. Our guest is going to go home with a
new color television set.
You get the Jawbox.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me, man.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I really enjoyed talking to Bill, and I would recommend diving deep into all of his work, even if you end up like me, sleep-deprived at 3 a.m., watching old SNL sketches. And you should definitely check out Bill's new show, Barry, on HBO. And also, don't miss Documentary Now, which you can find on IFC and Netflix. I also highly recommend his 2014 film, The Skeleton Twins, also starring Kristen Wiig. So check all that out. Now, for those of you who are new to the off-camera experience, we're a little different from other podcasts out there in the sense that we are first and foremost a TV show. So if you're liking the podcast experience, I guarantee that you will love the TV experience even more. And if you have DirecTV, it's easy. You can find us on the Audience Network, channel 239. And if you don't have DirecTV, you can head straight to our website, offcamera.com, and get a monthly subscription to the show. For just $4.99 a month, you can have unlimited access to our entire archive to watch on any device as many times as you want. And let's be clear, I love that you are listening to the podcast, but I urge you to try the TV show. So please, check that out. It's a great way to support the show. And another great way to support the show is to order the off-camera magazine. That's the print version of our show, and it contains the entire uncut conversation, plus the exclusive photographs that I take of each artist when they appear on the show. You can also put Off Camera on your coffee table. We still have some signed copies of Off Camera The Portraits, which is our 275-page collection of all the artists featured on the show. It makes a great gift, and like I said, there are still some signed first editions left, so pick one of those up. And maybe the best way to support the show is just by not keeping it to yourself. Tell your friends about Off Camera through all those pesky social media channels.
We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you want to write me an email, I love hearing from listeners on just about any subject. So if you have a guest suggestion or just want to share something about your artistic life, drop me a line. I'm sam@offcamera.com. I'm also happy to forward on emails to anyone on our staff that you wish to personally thank for all their hard work. There's Crawford Shippey, who produces the show and actually finds all of these iconic artists and somehow convinces them to come on the show. There's Sasha Snow, who manages our studio and assists in all the logistics. And there's Nathan Shields, who mixed and edited the very sounds you are listening to right now. There's Michaela Galvin, who's responsible for all the visual aspects of Off Camera. There's Amy Jones, who makes us sound a little bit smarter. And Kara Johnson, who painstakingly writes down every word that is said on the show. Lastly, there's Matt Davidson, who, truth be told, I'm just not sure what his title is, but the whole place would fall apart without him. These are the people that I count on every week to make this show a reality, and I'm lucky that they all believe in what we are doing and that they work so hard to make it happen. Now, most importantly, be sure to join us next time when I sit down with actor Dan Stevens, who is just too smart to be as handsome as he is.
We all inherently have incredible imaginations as children. As soon as people start telling you, oh, that's a bit weird, maybe soften that edge or whatever, then we start to kind of curb that. And it's either a byproduct of just being human, or it's for the benefit of mankind in some way. But it really exists. We're not making this shit up.
You may think that he is just a Downton Abbey deserting, shape-shifting, ex-Brooklynite Brit who relocated to Los Angeles after helping Disney earn $1 billion with Beauty and the Beast, and who then broke every rule about acting on FX's Legion, on the way to developing a semi-permanent American accent. But you would be mistaken. He is also a failed stand-up comedian and a Cambridge graduate who started a literary magazine in his spare time as a way to share his theories about technology, childhood, saltwater births, and the land grab on your imagination. Oh, and he just might be inventing a flying car. See you next time, Off Camera.